For years, in her quiet way, and particularly in Harrod's, Lady Fletcher, wife of the judge, had looked forward to the title. She received it and was disappointed. It was not that in Harrod's the most surprising people have titles now. It was not that her daily help, who had wandering thoughts, didn't cotton on, or that the dry cleaner who called on Tuesdays and the laundry Thursdays had known her for years as Fletcher number 22 and would not change now. It was not that her friends called her Enid as before, just rather louder. You know Enid Fletcher, don't you? But all this was certainly rather sad. No, it went further. When Enid had been a child at Swanage, something may have stirred in the square, solid little girl, an envy and a conviction that a title meant romance. A mistake. Lord Fletcher was quite unaware of his wife's disappointment. Asked on the bench, as he was very occasionally, about his wife's diversions, they were childless, he said she had a finger in various good works and was very fond of cooking. And so she had, and so she was. And she liked the order of her life. She had not been at all unhappy their 24 years of evenings together in the fawn and cream sitting-room. She liked her occasional luncheons given to other Wimbledon ladies and legal wives, never more than four, round the big mahogany table, the silver properly polished, and, through the window of the tidy shorn garden, with the well-pruned hybrid teas, the pampas clump. She liked the way the electric fire was switched on always half an hour before dinner and switched off again by Lewis as they left the dining-room each evening, year in, year out. She liked Lewis. But her life lacked occurrences, and mistakenly, and she realized now ridiculously, she had expected the title to bring them. Lewis, she had said, congratulations. Congratulations, he had said, and kissed her. Congratulations, Lady Fletcher. Oh, really, Lewis, I don't suppose I shall take it up. Christmas came and went at their usual hotel in Rye, which Lewis liked because of the birds on the marshes. The hotel was too hot, but the bath water was unpredictable. On Christmas Day, paper-hatted, but not talkative, at small tables, everyone ate turkey, cooked on Christmas Eve. She felt shivery and took the flu. I'll have it at home, she thought, as though it were a baby. And the judge drove slowly back in the sleet to Wimbledon, where the flu became a long and painful attack of bronchitis. You need the sun, said the doctor. The Bahamas. You don't want Wimbledon in January. I'd really advise it, he said to the judge at the door, and the judge stood in the hall among the Edwardian panels for quite some time after he had gone, thinking. He was capable of thought, and even of decision, being unusual in his profession. Lady Fletcher was in Jamaica in a week, though in all the wrong clothes. In the thinnest of these, she lay by the pool of the beautiful hotel outside Kingston, under a yellow cotton tree. In the gold sunshine, the square black maids walked in dresses of pink and white cotton, their fat faces always smiling and shining, their dark round hands lifted 20 times a day in a wave. And how are you today, Lady Fletcher, ma'am? I'm very well, Lavinia. Waiters in banana-yellow coats appeared silently with trays of rum and orange juice. "'My, you look better today, Lady Fletcher, my lady. You've got a light in the eye, ma'am.' "'I don't know about the eye,' she said. "'I do feel very well. "'You going to be staying with us now 2-3 months, my lady?' "'Oh, yeah, I hope so, but I'm afraid not.' At the end of a week, in a new apple-green cotton dress and white sandals, her skin a golden pink, Enid Fletcher lay serene. There, by the pool, from the very beginning, Enid Fletcher had found her kingdom, and in it had held her court. Everyone came to the pool at least once a day. Pad, pad, pad they came, at 8 and 1 and 5 o'clock. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Lady Fletcher, lovely day. Splash! After a swim, they pressed a bell for drinks, beat themselves about the shoulders and thighs with towels, then settled beside her on the smooth stones or on the long chairs, oiling themselves, the men wriggling strong brown toes. Mr. Luft was the first, an American, dark, copper-coloured, huge, immensely handsome. Not too young, either, at least 45, and covered all over in curly dark hair like Tarzan. He had Tarzan-like teeth, too, and dark crimson swimming trunks, narrow, and the most splendid gold watch, with a gold-ribbed strap which glinted under the water in the sun. "Oh, you've forgotten your watch," she cried the first time she saw him, swimming strongly towards her through the green water, before they had even been introduced, on her very first day. "That's okay," he said, heaving himself out on bulging muscles. "Waterproof." "Oh, but they never really are." "This one is, ma'am. It's a real stinger." "What you drinking?" "Name's Luft. Hal Luft." "I'm a Enid Fletcher." "Hi then, Enid. What you drinking?" There began a pleasant and, since Luft was always the very earliest home from the business of the day in Kingston, a very private conversation. Private save only for the pool boy, who hardly ever lifted his eyes. And there were the handsome South Americans who only spoke Spanish but who smiled and bowed a great deal, a dazzling Bolivian beauty with a gracious acknowledgement of the head. And there was Mr. McCrindle. "It's an interesting name, McCrindle," said Lady Fletcher. "Is it Scottish?"
"That I cannot say," said Mr. McCrindle, "for I am a Cuban."
"A Cuban? How exciting! But I thought..." "Ah," he said softly. He was a very little man, blonde, with a small English military moustache and sloping shoulders like a debutante.
"I'm a B.C. Cuban."
"Goodness!
A B.C. Cuban is a before Castro Cuban. I am an exile, ma'am. I have, of course, firmly established a domicile for myself in the southern part of the United States."
Carefully extended sentences poured effortlessly out from under his pale moustache, like ectoplasm, she thought. Like Athene emerging from the head of Zeus. Then, whatever made me think that, she asked herself. Sometimes during the day, of course, when the men were at their business deals and the sightseers sightseeing, she was quite alone by the pool. Alone except for the pool boy, whose job it was, all day long, to walk round its edge with a long shrimping net, casting for spiders, wasps, and leaves. He was utterly silent. One evening, after 5, Luft came back to the hotel after work, rather later than usual. It was very hot. Hot as June, Lavinia said. He called, "Hi!" and flung himself and his gold watch into the pool, swam across, heaved himself out, sat down beside her, and put her hand upon her thigh. Before she could quite think, McCrindle appeared through the hibiscus bushes. He stopped at the pool's edge. Luft at once removed his hand.
"Hi, Mac," he called. "Come on and join the party."
McCrindle turned and disappeared. That evening, Lewis arrived from England, pale but quite jaunty, and they dined in the hotel. Neither Luft nor McCrindle was present. That night, later, when she sat with the judge and some Jamaican lawyers and friends on the terrace, McCrindle came hurriedly through the bar and cut Lady Fletcher dead. She felt wretched, almost tearful, and another new and at first unrecognized emotion, not altogether disagreeable. She talked pleasantly and more than usual, and she knew what it was she felt. She felt powerful. For the time of the year, it was a very hot night. When the friends had gone, the reunited Fletchers walked in the grounds a little and hoped it would be cool in the new room they were to share that night. "It's the bungalow by the pool, dear," she said. "I hope it won't be noisy," said the judge. "Do they sit out round there at night?" "Oh, I'm sure not," she said. There are no lights, and all the children will be in bed." "Let's hope so. I'm tired. 11 hours flying. It's 6 hours onwards for me, you know. It's 5 in the morning already for me now." "Does it seem madness?" she asked. She put her arm through his. "To have come?" He said, "No, not madness," and was soon asleep. But Lady Fletcher was restless. This bed seemed harder. She didn't like having to keep the shutters up. And she kept on hearing footsteps around the pool behind them. To try to get to sleep, she began to allow herself uncharacteristic thoughts and fancies. They expanded into scenes, almost stories, that insisted on the presence of new friends, particularly of Hal Luft and Mr. McCrindle. She dozed at last and dreamed of being caught in nets. Then she was quite awake and sitting up in bed, her eyes wide open and round. Outside, behind the bed, so close it seemed to be almost in her ear, she heard a light, passionless, almost plaintive voice. Although it was so close she could not distinguish the words, but the cadences, the pauses, the insistence, the eternal practice flow were unmistakable.
McCrindle must be sitting by the pool, just behind her up the steps. He must be sitting by the pool and talking to himself. On and on went the voice, and as she listened, it dawned on her, she did not know how, that Mr. McCrindle was not alone. He was with one other person. One other person. One who was keeping silent. The two people must be together by the pool, and somehow she knew that whoever they were, whoever was with him was, well, not standing up or moving about. Never before would she have imagined that you can tell from a voice whether or not it comes from an upright position. Beyond doubt, this voice reclined. "I must," said Lady Fletcher, "I must see." Silently, she got out of bed and walked to the little garden door in the lobby behind her bed. The first laugh came again, Mr. McCrindle's light laugh. All she could see through the fixed wooden shutter of the door was a length of wide chaise longue, with some legs lying on it. But it was moonlight, and the moonlight caught a glitter of something. A something. A wrist. The wrist curled round someone else's neck. The wrist was covered with black hairs and was encircled by a magnificent gold watch. In the moonlight, the light laugh came again, followed by the deep and unmistakable laugh of Luft. She let the shutter clatter loudly down. "Hello," called Lewis. Outside there was silence. Next morning, all alone, Lady Fletcher lay and watched the pool boy gracefully fishing. She and Lewis would be alone together now, and she would never sit here by the pool again. Never again. Her gaze never left the pool boy. She followed every moment of his net, the spread of his arms, the sinews in his legs. He looked up at her at length, straight into her face, and waited. "Last night," she said, "the most extraordinary thing. I heard lovers talking by the pool. It must have been 3 o'clock in the morning." His face was still. "The curious thing," she went on with a laugh, not keeping down her voice, looking at her smart pink nails, "the curious thing was I looked out and it was, well, it was two men." The pool boy went on staring at her for a while, and not a leaf stirred. At length he said, turning back to the pool, "Sometimes it is so." He straightened up again, and this time their eyes met each other. He said gently, "Some strange things are so." "Well, I must pack now," she said briskly after a moment. "We leave today. Goodbye." He said no more, and she went sensibly into the bungalow. In the shadowy, quiet room, she stood and looked, looked and looked, focusing at last on the image of the perfect stranger in the mirror that she would never see again. "I want him," she said to it. "I want him." The face of the stranger began to blush, and tears came into its eyes. Then she turned away from it, shut the door, and methodically started folding the clothes. She worked faster soon and more confidently. An amiable, able woman, and steady. Lady Fletcher, a woman of title, wife of the judge.